Connection This Hour was made in 2010. As we've said, we've all had family and friends that served in Vietnam, and many, many members who made it home have never gone back as civilians. But 40 years after serving on the Brown Water Navy, and after watching three men die alongside him, a man named Raleigh Kidder wanted to know what modern Vietnam is really like. What is the country that we left there? How has it changed in a new generation? What did the young Vietnamese think of Americans? He decided it was time to go back. And then, afterwards, he decided it was time to find the families of the three people who died alongside him. And he traveled across North America to find them. Their stories impacted him powerfully, and they impacted me powerfully in a book called Backtracking in Brown Water. Raleigh Kidder is our guest in studio doing the rare thing. Raleigh, most people who served in Vietnam have not been back. Why did you go back?
I think I always wanted to see what the country was like in peacetime. And about half my tour in Vietnam, after the combat phase, I was a part of the Vietnamization program, turning the war over, you might say, to Vietnamese. And I got to meet a lot of Vietnamese, and including one who did escape and came to the United States the night that the communists took over. So I was interested in going back and seeing the country as it is today, and I was fortunate to be able to do that under his guidance, this individual.
And again, the book is called Backtracking in Brown Water. It's available now, and in full disclosure, I've known Raleigh for years, and I had a chance to see the manuscript. When I saw the manuscript early on, I asked to be a part of it because I thought it was a powerful book, and I offered just my services as a copy editor. So I'm a copy editor on this book. That's it, and there is no money in it for me. As Raleigh knows, most authors, there's no money in it for anybody, right, Raleigh?
Well, let me just comment on what you've said. I commend you on your book, Summer in a Glass, I think was the name of it, about the Finger Lakes wine business. And I read it and thought it was terrific. And when I was getting ready to get this book published, I wanted your eyes on it, Evan, because you have the eyes of an author and you've been through it yourself. And I would say this, I think the book is better because of that, especially the introduction. In this book, I'm talking about various time periods. One is 1969 and 1970. Another is the trip back in 2010. Another are conversations today, you might say, with the families and family members who survived the men that I knew in Vietnam. So there's different time frames, and to try and put those in context, I think the introduction especially is a lot better, and so I appreciate your input on it, and thanks for having me on this program.
Well, it's full disclosure. There you go, and Raleigh would be on whether I was involved with the book or not, because it's a powerful and important book, especially for a generation that, you know, my generation who did not go to Vietnam, but I also want to hear from our listeners, and we've already been hearing from listeners, and we're going to get to that in a minute on social media, talking about not only the experience of Vietnam, or if you've had, we all have had family and friends who've served. I've asked the question, what's your impression today? What do you think Vietnam would be like today? And what's the general impression on whether or not the war was worth it? And interestingly enough, Raleigh, a lot of people have said they don't want to say the war wasn't worth it because they don't want to dishonor those who died or dishonor those who served and lived like you, but you don't take it as dishonor, do you?
No, I think the war was a mistake. I think it was an avoidable war. My view back at the time, though, 1969, I was in the Navy, and I said, you know, this is my generation's war, like it or not, and I thought I would be ducking my responsibility, you might say, if I didn't go to Vietnam. So I volunteered to go. I was on patrol boats in the Mekong Delta. And also, I don't think it diminishes the sacrifice made by Americans who might die in an ill-fated situation. Right. We've had many conflicts in this country that ended up not the way we wanted them to. And so I have great respect for those men that did die. I think their motives were good, and I think that their memories should be remembered in that way. In terms of the country today, it's probably what it would have been like had there been no war. That's the sad thing. I mean, it's now controlled by a communist government. There's no open access in the media like you know here. As some of the Vietnamese told me when they quietly would pull me aside in Vietnam, you know, we don't have Facebook over here. We don't have this. We don't have that, right? On the other hand, economically, the country is as advanced and maybe more so than some of its neighbors like Thailand, the Philippines, and so on. My experience in traveling in those countries is that Vietnam is really very economically on top of things, and their young people are really running the country. Over half the country now is below the age of 35. They don't remember the war, and they're quite pro-American and pro-Western in their ideas. So I was glad I went back to see it, and the book, I hope, conveys some of that.
Yeah, so you were not someone who was put off by, say, a higher profile example of what John Kerry came back and said.
No, you know, John Kerry came back and criticized the war. I came home at about the same time, 1970. I just felt that I knew the war was winding down. Am I getting involved in opposing the war publicly in some way? I was running for political office at the time as well, so I had an opportunity to criticize the war, but I just kept quiet about it. I didn't defend it, I don't think, the war, but I didn't come out and actively criticize it. The war was winding down. More people were going to die before it got done with, and I just felt it was more fitting, for at least in my situation, to sort of keep my mouth shut about my own views. But in the book, it's quite clear that, you know, reading Bernard Fall and other authors like that prior to going to Vietnam, I really wondered about its viability. And then when I got to Vietnam during the war, I was in some situations where I could view the corruption of the South Vietnamese government. Not that the North didn't have its own corruption problems. Today the country has some of those. But it's pretty hard to win a war when you have an ally that was as corrupt and as, you know, as ineffectual, you might say, as the South Vietnamese government.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, 585-263-9994. Raleigh Kidder is my guest for the hour. He's the author of the new book, Backtracking in Brown Water. Went back to Vietnam 40 years after serving there in 2010, and also tracked down the families of three men who died alongside him 40 years later to see what the long-term cost of war is. We often get caught up in unfortunately, statistics that are not names and real stories, and Raleigh went across the continent, really, and fleshed some of those out for us. And we're going to be getting to those because they were really powerful stuff. But I want to talk about 2010, because you decide to go back, and Tu Trang Van is his name, is an important part of this. He is a South Vietnamese gentleman who you met there, and he had to make a decision in a matter of hours when Saigon was falling, right?
Correct.
So when Saigon's falling, too, and like many people around him, and I did not know this until reading the book, again, great history for me, they have to decide, do we stay and essentially cross our fingers that we're not going to be persecuted for our involvement in the war, or do we uproot our family and get out and get on a plane somewhere, anywhere? What did he do?
It was in the Navy, of course, of the South Vietnamese Navy, and they had not been told that the communist North was about ready to take over. They thought they were still holding their own. They were down south of Saigon, got called in at 9 o'clock at night, and they said, hey, the Army's just notified us they're surrendering at midnight. So he went back, talked to his wife. His wife and two daughters came. His sister, who was down visiting for the weekend.
And their kids were young kids, right?
They were 3 years old and 1 year old. They got on a small Mike boat, it's called in the Navy, and headed into the South China Sea. There were some Vietnamese destroyers there picking up people. They finally got to Subic Bay in the Philippines, to Guam. And then one night in 1975, I got a phone call at home from a Church World Service group saying they were from a refugee center at Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg. And did I know a Tu Trang Van? I said, of course I do. He said, well, can we set up a phone call for the next day? And Tu needed a sponsor, and our church in Jamestown sponsored him. And then he got a night watchman's job. And he had a college degree, Evan, but he had no paperwork. When you leave in 3 hours, you don't bring all the files.
Right.
You know? So he had to go back and got a community college degree and then went on to Jacksonville for his four-year degree. And he had a career at Shell Oil in Houston.
And he's done well for himself.
Yeah, he's now retired, pardon me, and he arranged this trip back in 2010.
All right, so you and Tu decide you're going to go back. And, you know, again, you served on what they called the Brown Water Navy. And instead of just going back to Vietnam, you wanted to retrace a lot of your routes. Why did you want to do that?
Well, there's a lot of the combat I was on, a lot of the rivers I wanted to see. Tu had been a part of that. He had also become a commander of what was called a PBR division. Patrol Boat River, it was a 32-foot fast patrol boat, heavily armed. And Tu had been on those boats. So we went to these rivers, and in one case we rented a sampan, went down the river. Another case, there was a highway now constructed along the Cambodian border on a canal called the Vintay Canal. We drove down that. And fortunately, the maps that we'd used in Vietnam during the war had been declassified. So I was able to take the old grid line maps, the kind that military people know about, that have kilometer breakdowns where you could call in artillery and stuff. And I used those and crossed them with the road maps of today. And we actually were able to find these old ambush sites and some of these other places where the action took place. And so Tu really made that possible. Of course, he was also our interpreter in 2010. And so it all worked out in a phenomenal way. It's one of those great relationships. You meet a person, and I never thought I'd see Tu again, but of course, he became a big part of our life later on.
And I want to read a part of that road trip of going back, because look at the juxtaposition in 40 years. A Japanese made, this is quoting from Raleigh's book, a Japanese-made SUV carries us south on what is now a four-lane highway lined with factories, commercial shops, and industrial parks. We stop at a fancy restaurant that Tu says is run by the government. Tourist buses are parked outside. Inside, Australians at the next table are traveling on what brochures call the three-day Mekong Delta Tour. Amazing. 40 years ago, a tour on this stretch of highway meant you were in a war zone. Today, the tour groups are en route for boat rides on small canals with a final stop at the floating market in Kanto. Tu and I, instead, are headed for a small village called Quayan in the Mangthit River. It's one of the places that we patrolled during the war. And you write, I have with me a photo from 1969 of an old French church we would like to visit. In the courtyard of this church, the toughest man I ever met killed an enemy soldier using a pop flare as a weapon. War requires some strange and awful actions. Today, it is a place for prayer and worship. That night, 40 years ago, it was a strategic location, ideal for an ambush. What was that juxtaposition like?
It was incredible, of course, coming up on the old French church. I knew it immediately when I saw it. This is 2010.
And you wouldn't have known that it was still there, right?
No, I didn't know it was there, but I knew where it was because I had the grid line maps. And pulled in there, and there was a young man waiting on the bank. He lives next door. Has his motor scooter, a motorcycle like most Vietnamese do today, had a cell phone, introduced us to his mom and his family. And the church is active again. At the time when I was there in 1969, the church had been abandoned and was booby-trapped, supposedly. This fellow Olson didn't care about that. He went in and did his work anyway. But I think even Olson would be glad to see that it's again a house of worship. And that kind of story, I think, means something to some of the veterans that I served with and who've responded since they've read the book. I think they feel like maybe they've come to some kind of closure by going back to the country through the book.
Did you feel that closure?
I felt it, yes. I think finally meeting the families of three guys I knew that died, and their response has been very gratifying. I mean, you worry about writing about somebody who's you were the last person to see these men, you know, and now you're talking to their families many years later. And so I would interview them, and then I would type up the interview and send it to them, and they would comment on it. And so finally what had ended up in the book is what they had approved, and the comment since the book is done from all of them has been very gratifying. And I think for them, it was it was important for them to get it into print once they went through the process of interviewing with me.
We're talking to Raleigh Kidder, the author of Backtracking in Brown Water. He's a former state assemblyman from Jamestown and Chautauqua, and wrote a book about not only going back to Vietnam 40 years later to find out what is the country that we left behind in that war that a lot of people thought was a mistake, but he also then traveled North America to find the families of three service members who died alongside him. And I got to tell you, Raleigh, the one that hit me hardest, because everyone knows in war there are tragedies. But I want to read a section here about Chief Eldon Tozer. You write, quote, I was forced to revisit some of the worst experiences of my life. Floating down the river today, I see landmarks that stir the memories. We pass a familiar spot that today appears unremarkable. But you do not forget where you were when you found out a friend had died. I still feel like I can see the man we called the chief standing in front of me. The worst part of this experience, this backtracking in time, has been the discovery of details I had never known. When the chief lay mortally wounded, I learned that he had pleaded, I can't die. I didn't completely understand why this was true until I found his family. You found his family. And what you found out was Chief Eldon Tozer was married with four children, a 9-year-old girl, twin boy and girl at age 7, and a 4-year-old girl. And he goes off to Vietnam, and then his wife, their mother, dies in a car accident. So he had to fly home in an emergency situation, and the children are grieving. And when he finally went back to Vietnam, he told them, "I'll be back after Christmas, and that'll be it." Did you know at the time that Chief Tozer, the man you were serving next to you, had lost his wife, and they had, four kids had lost a mother?
We knew his wife had died, and he'd been away for emergency leave. What we were amazed at is that he came back, because I'm sure the Navy would have let him stay in the United States because of the situation. And, you know, Evan, there's a lot of talk in World War II and other conflicts about loyalty to unit. Maybe that was why he came back. Maybe he was just so distraught he didn't know what else to do. Maybe he was a career Navy man. He'd been in the Navy 11 years, and maybe he felt it was better for his career if he finished up his tour. Who knows what his reasoning? He never explained it to me. But the night he was killed, and he'd made that statement, was one of the driving forces between my going on a search for those kids after my 2010 trip. And it wasn't really easy because the connection I had, I found out he was Canadian. I didn't know that. I got on the internet and found a Tozer up in Gaspé Peninsula, Quebec, talked to her, and it was his sister. And she'd lost track of the kids because they'd been raised in America, in the United States, by the other side of the family. But she said she thought they were raised in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area, and I did another people search, and I found a woman whose middle name was Tozer, her last name wasn't, and I called out of the blue one night, and her husband answered, and I said, "I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm sorry to bother you, but I'm looking for, you know, a daughter of a friend of mine." He says, "You're going to want to talk to my wife." And she got on the phone, and that led to an interview, and the interview itself is interesting. Her sister had started a restaurant in Ionia, Michigan called Eldon's Cafe, named after their dad, and inside on the wall is a picture of him and so on, and that's where we met and had our meeting.
If you're holding on the line to talk, just stay there for one quick second because I just want to put the point on this story that these four kids, 9, 7, 7, and 4 years old, lose their mother in a car accident and then their father in Vietnam 2 months later. And then the uncle who took them in ends up in a divorce, and they had to go elsewhere. It's about as heart-wrenching a story as you can hear, but we're going to talk to Raleigh in just a second about what he learned when he finally tracked down the family 40 years later. Let's take our first call. This is Mary Lynn in Webster. Thanks for calling Connections, Mary.
Hi, Evan. Oh, what a touching story. I'm listening with great interest because I went to Vietnam last year as one of those tourists he talked about. And I spent 16 days there, and it is a beautiful country. And he's correct. So many people are, you know, under the age of 35. Our guide was like 34. And they have no animosity toward Americans. But I went back to assuage my guilt for what we did. I was not in favor of the war, and I'm glad the author says that if you're not in favor of the war, that doesn't dishonor the people who served and died there. So I just wanted to say that it's a beautiful, beautiful country.
Well, I appreciate the call, Marilyn. Raul, any thoughts on that, Raul?
No, a lot of people now do travel to Vietnam. There's some wonderful, wonderful tours. And when I went back, the second week, I didn't go down to the rivers of the Mekong Delta. I traveled with a friend from the U.K., a guy that wanted to go back and wanted to go to Vietnam and never been there. And we did travel up to Hue and Da Nang and Ha Long Bay and some of the tourist sites. I'd never been to Hanoi, of course, because that was where the enemy was.
Sure.
And I would just say that in interviewing one of the families of one of the guys I knew that was killed, they were from Long Island, and there was a movie out called Born on the 4th of July years ago that talked about the split and the divisive nature of the war and how people and families in Long Island were disagreeing about it. Well, he was from Long Island, and his sister said, you know, I didn't really agree with the war, but he was going over. So she said, I didn't really argue with him. She said, I told him to be careful and blah, blah, blah. There's the fact that it was a divisive time in American life, I think, is a given, and But I'm glad that Americans are traveling there now, and it is a place to go see. And it's a wonderful trip if you're not a veteran. I mean,
yeah, Mary Lynn, one more quick question. When you talk to some of the younger Vietnamese, I'm going to ask you this, and I'll ask Raleigh the same question. You said that they didn't hold animosity towards Americans. What is their thought in general about the United States of America?
Well, they like to come over and visit. Some of them, some of the young people I talked to had visited. Our guide had visited, and they were pretty positive. And by the way, on the trip, there were 20 of us. There was one veteran who was going back just for just to see the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting to talk with him as we went to the different places, because we covered from Hanoi down to Saigon and Can Tho and all those places. So he was very interesting.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Mary Lynn. We appreciate that. Raleigh, you talked to the under 35 group, as you said in the book. You know, they didn't grow up with the war. And if they didn't hold animosity, well, they don't have Facebook, so maybe they're do they still want certain freedoms? Because as you say, it's communist rule. There are certain freedoms they don't have.
One night when I was in Vietnam in 2010, I got invited by a Peace Corps volunteer I knew that was teaching at the University of Da Nang to teach English. And so I did that for two nights in Da Nang. And there were, you know, different levels of English-speaking kids they wanted these kids to hear American English. They hear more British English, I think, because mm-hmm. of the Australian presence and mm-hmm. so on. And but one girl asked, she said, well, I told her I thought the country was doing well and it was nice to be back and to see the economic activity. And she's popped up, though, on her own, and she said, well, you know, you may think it's great here, but she said, you know, I'm 26 years old, and if I was in America, I wouldn't be living at home with my mom and dad, probably. At least I'd have a chance to have an apartment, be out on my own. And then she brought up the Facebook issue and so on. And another guy I flew in a plane with back from Hanoi to Saigon, with Ho Chi Minh City is what it's called now, but the locals call it Saigon. He was a media person, and he had been covering the World Soccer Cup in South Africa. And he basically said, you know, I had to move to Hanoi. I'm from the South. He said, because ultimately in this country, unless you get connected in the North, they won the war, you can't move up the chain of command, right? So, I mean, there's a feeling in the country that they would like a more open government. And I think it's like China. Eventually, people, once they start making money and moving into the middle class, are going to demand a change in the government. We haven't seen it yet, but I think it probably is coming in that part of the world.
We're talking to Raleigh Kidder, the author of Backtracking in Brown Water, a book available now. He went back to Vietnam 40 years after serving there on the Brown Water Navy, you called it, right, Raleigh?
Yeah, the rivers there. Think of the Mississippi River, always brown and milky chocolate. And of course, it's a tidal in the delta. The rivers move both ways every day because the tides change, and so the currents in these rivers would change back and forth. And some of the siltation came out of China, where the river started, of course, but some of it's just from the fact that it's a tidal, muddy type area. But the Navy called us the Brown Water Navy, and since then people continue to do so. So this backtracking in brown water, that's where it comes from.
Yeah. And 263-WXXI, 263-9994, if you want to weigh in here. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and when we come back, we're going to revisit that story and find out what Raleigh discovered when he finally did find the family of Eldon Tozer. Again, this was an American, well, this was a service member with roots all across this continent who went to war with a wife and four children under the age of 10 at home. His wife died in a car accident when he was serving. He came home in the emergency situation for the funeral, went back to Vietnam, and was killed in Vietnam. What an awful impact on the family. Raleigh, 40 years later, found that family. We're going to talk about what he learned from them next. This is Connections. You're listening to member-supported public radio. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On this Tuesday afternoon, we're talking about backtracking in brown water with author and former state assemblyman Roland Kidder, who is in studio with us. If you're just joining us, in full disclosure, I've known Raleigh Kidder for many years and had a chance to see the manuscript early on, and I told him I wanted to be a part of the project, even if it meant just providing a copy edit and some basic ideas. Not because there's a financial stake. I haven't made a penny off this, though he might buy me lunch today. But
I haven't made any either.
That's what authors find out, you know. It's not about making money. It's about telling important stories, and I thought these were a collection of some of the more important stories I'd ever read. So Backtracking in Brown Water is the book. And Raleigh went back to Vietnam and then found the families of these service members who fought and died alongside him. On Twitter, Original says, fascinating show today, Evan, and thanks to him for the book. And if you want to call the program, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You found Chief Tozer's daughters. And what did you expect to find, Raleigh? Did you have any expectations? I mean, it's 40 years later that you got to call them and say, I know this is sort of strange, but 40 years ago I served with them and I want to talk to you, and you don't know if they're going to be receptive.
You know, that was one of the great surprises in all three families that I interviewed. They were very receptive. I think there may have been some reluctance initially. Mm-hmm. Who is this guy? What's he trying to do? And so forth and so on. Chief Tozer, just to expand a little bit, he was a chief petty officer. I was a lieutenant JG in the officer corps, but we were both patrol officers in charge of two boats in a PBR division, Patrol Boat River Division. The night Tozer was killed, I was supposed to have been in that location. It was an area we called Blood Alley because there had been a lot of fighting there. But the water was going down, the monsoon was over, and the heavier boats that we were working with were going to be pulling out. And so the Navy sent me as an officer back to our base camp to learn how to coordinate artillery and airstrikes and things like that. And Tozer went to where I was going to be. And so in the middle of the night, I mean, he called me on a radio, and I was at the base camp, and the machine guns were going off. And then I couldn't, he wouldn't respond. So I sent helicopters in, and by the time they got there and illuminated the area, he wasn't there. And then the boat came in, and everybody was wounded on the boat. And the thing that amazed me is they were all talking. Nobody was unconscious, and Tozer was dying, but he was conscious also. His kids, what I found out after finding out where his daughter was, I went out and interviewed his two daughters up in Michigan. When his wife had died, one of the sad things, Evan, is that he was in Vietnam at that time.
Yeah.
And they had a babysitter, and she was killed in a car accident, and apparently they had some time before they knew who was killed.
The mom was killed in a car accident.
Yeah, and so they got picked up by the police from the babysitter and taken to, like, a juvenile detention area, and she was on the other side of the fence from her brother and sisters, and they were there for like 4 or 5 days until Eldon, they flew him back as fast as they could from Vietnam, and he came in there and got him out of that juvenile detention area. And then he said, you're going to go live with my brother, my wife's brother in Oklahoma. And then after about a year, this is after, of course, he had died, the brother was going through a divorce, and he couldn't raise 8 kids. He had 4 of his own. And so they went into an orphanage for about a year. And then finally, another family member from their mother's side came down from Michigan and got him out of this orphanage in Oklahoma and got him back. And they had lived a relatively normal life. But you know, it's always had an impact on those kids, and still does. And they've turned out okay, but I'd say not great. And I think this is one of those things that happens in war that I wanted to write about. Is, you know, it's not all roses at the end of these things. War is a nasty business, and it has bad ramifications. But I was pleased that, and I think they were pleased to know more about their dad in his final days by speaking with me.
I want to just revisit that moment where they found out their dad had died, because 2 months earlier, their mother dies in a car accident. And this is the daughter talking to you. Quote, the day they told me he had died, I was in complete denial. I don't know how I stayed together or how the family kept me together. Uncle Bill came to our school and took the three of us who were there out of class in order to tell us. He had tears in his eyes when he picked us up at school. His own kids were not in the car, so I thought that maybe we'd been taken out of school because we'd done something wrong. He didn't speak on the way home. When we got home, the relatives were there again, just like when Mom had died. And you'd think I could have put two and two together and have figured out the bad news, but I didn't. Then Uncle Bill took me for a walk. He held my hand, then picked me up and said, Janet, I have something to tell you. He told me my dad had died. I don't remember anything about what happened after that. I don't even know.
Yeah.
It's just...
It's really, there was a, at the end of the book, you know, next to the last chapter, I speak about the night Tozer was killed, and I talk about the carnage on the boat and things. And I was reluctant, in a way, to put all of it in because it's pretty gory. And I have sent a copy of that chapter to Janet and her sister, Donna. I said, I don't want to put this in unless you it's okay with you, because it's pretty ugly stuff. And but they said, no, if it happened, put it in. And so and then I received an email from Janet just last week, having read the book, and she thanked me again for the way I put it together and so forth. The book ends in a, how do you talk about three guys you knew that died? And I decided to end the book in a chapter called Requiem. And I used to sing in a church choir, and there's a Mozart piece called Requiem, you know, and we used to sing it in Latin. I never knew Latin, but I put the English as well as the Latin in the book when I speak of these three men, and went to their grave sites. And of course, the last one I talk about is going up to this little cemetery in Quebec, just 100 graves there, probably up over the Bonaventure River, and going to Tozer's grave. And so. Anyway, I probably said more than I should.
No, that's all right. The book's called Backtracking in Brown Water. Roland Kidder is the author. He's in studio for the hour. It's a beautiful and moving book. And the one thing I want to make sure we're clear on here, Raleigh, is that at the end of this process for you, going back, retracing your route, and then finding the families, there's no doubt there's catharsis there. You know, you're not gonna undo the past or bring people back. But I read the book and I felt like I understood the business of war a little better, even though we're talking about a war that's 40 years old now. And unfortunately, on Facebook today and in the past hour, we're getting comments from viewers who say, what did we learn from Vietnam? If you look at modern wars, what are we learning? And I wonder if this book will help us understand it anyway. What are your conclusions?
Well, I hope that if people read the book, that they'll understand it. We did learn lessons in Vietnam. I think we've forgotten them, or we continue to forget them. One is that somebody has to deliver the goods in a war, and the people with their feet on the ground and boots on the ground do it. I don't think Chief Tozer, Jim Rost, Bob Olson was probably the most gung-ho, the Army guy that I write about in here. He loved the Army, and... But I don't think any of them ever expressed to me that they thought that this was a great cause that the United States necessarily needed to be caught up in. I think they looked upon it a little bit like me in a fatalistic way. You know, back in those days, people were afraid communism was going to sweep down through Asia. Nobody talked about the fact that the Vietnamese for 1,000 years have hated the Chinese. I don't think they were ever going to let the Chinese come down through their country. And after the war was over, they started fighting the Chinese again. But, you know, if you take one step before that, in Yugoslavia, when World War II ended, an independent communist state was created with which we did business. I think we probably could have done business with Ho Chi Minh back in those days in Vietnam and avoided this thing. But then, it wasn't too long after the McCarthy era, when everybody was communist scared of everything. And so we decided finally after the Korean War, we're going to stop it wherever it raises its head. And it was sort of doomed, I think, from the beginning. I think the French taught us that they should have taught us what it was going to be like when we went in. But I think we felt, well, we're the big Americans. We have more firepower. We have all that. But it takes more than firepower to win a conflict like this. And it takes more than technology. And so I'm always on the cautious side of this kind of thing. And I think, you know, one of the great qualities of our chief executives, our presidents in this country, should be caution. Because when you get to the military end, that's all there is. There's bullets flying, the talking's over with, and it would be much better if these things could be resolved in other ways. Not always can be.
Right.
But I think, you know, even if you read the histories of Lyndon Johnson, I think he regretted at the end of his time that he had really gone ahead with this. And would John Kennedy have done it? There's a lot of speculation about that. We've heard about the Fog of War and all these other books that have been written about it. But This is more of a book of people on the ground level and families on the ground level, and what happens and what happened here could probably happen again.
And unfortunately, a lot of people think that's what's happening. Tom writes to us on Facebook, the war that Raleigh is describing is symptomatic of how the American military and its associated complex of industrial defense partners have kept us steadily at war since December 7th, 1941. Do you agree with that, Raleigh?
I don't know if it's been steadily at war, but Eisenhower warned about it, of course. And I do think that if you're in the military, you tend to recommend military solutions. But in Vietnam, we were there as a military. We were supposed to be policemen, too. We were supposed to be rebuilding the country. We were supposed to be doing all these things that we're trying to do in Afghanistan, right? And it's not easy if you don't have a willing partner or a ready partner.
Right.
And that was one of the lessons of Vietnam.
Those are the questions that we see come up in places like Syria and others now. Intervene at what cost and with what expectation, especially if the parties you're intervening to help don't necessarily want you there. And so it's not a perfect parallel, but still lessons, right?
Let me just say this. And when George Bush Sr. was going to go into Baghdad, he was a World War II veteran, shot down, you know, in World War II, Sr. was. And he got on the road to Baghdad, and he said, what are we going to do if we get it? Who's going to help pay for it? Who's coming in with us? How do we get out of it? Now, these are questions, I think, that came from, because he had been through World War II.
Wise questions, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's inquisitive. Being inquisitive is important. But I don't want to mislead people to thinking that this book has an answer to all the issues on Vietnam.
But the book makes us think about the human cost of war. So many great war books are written by the people at the top, right?
Yeah.
This is much more, as you say, ground level. And then there are so many little aspects of this book that if for those of us who've never served overseas, we wouldn't know, especially in Vietnam. I had a friend pick up your book. I gave it to a friend to read. He said, I had no idea that suicide bombing existed back then. And, you know, you arrived. What was interesting to me was to find out that if you're serving in Vietnam, you don't just go to the remote parts of the country. You came into a central location and then kind of shipped out. And what happened when you arrived?
Well, the Navy put us in a hotel in Saigon called, in typical Navy fashion, they have to have a Navy name. It was called the Annapolis.
Okay.
But it was an old flea-bitten, kind of moth-eaten place that the French had, and no air conditioning, and had these slow fans, and we were all sweating all the time, waiting to get our orders to go wherever we were going to go in country. And one night, one of the enemy pulled up a motor scooter loaded with TNT and blew it up out in front and killed the Marine guard. And a bunch of friends of mine got Purple Hearts sitting and watching the evening movie. So I don't want to, they were on the second floor, so I don't need to go any further and tell you where they got wounded. But
yeah,
it was, we chuckled a little bit about how they're going to explain that to their grandchildren. But it was a wake up call for everybody in that hotel that, hey, we were going to a place that was. A war was going on.
You said the bomb caused the light fixtures to drop out of the ceiling.
Yeah, it was a big, it blew the whole front end of the hotel out, and the light fixture came down. I wanted to mention a World War II author that I think is somebody that I've always thought a lot of, and that is Ernie Pyle. He wrote books about the combat infantrymen on the ground. He didn't write about the generals and the admirals and Churchill and Stalin and all that. He talked about, and when we dedicated the World War II Memorial, I happened to be on the committee, and Tom Hanks came. He would have been a spokesman for us in raising the money to build the World War II Memorial. And I thought he would make a little speech. He got up and he read two paragraphs from Ernie Pyle about a captain in the army killed on a mountainside in Italy, and the men brought his body off the mountain that night, slung under a mule, and they put the body up against a wall, and the men would come down from the mountain and talk to him or salute him. And you know, to me, when Hanks read that Ernie Pyle piece, I said, you know, this is, if you're going to write about conflict and war and military history, that's the side of it that I think is most meaningful for me, is who was there and delivering the goods.
You also tracked down, we've been talking about Chief Tozer. There were two other families that you tracked down, the family of Bob Olson as well. And you said that Bob Olson was the toughest son of a gun you ever met. Why did you give him that description?
You know, Olson loved the Army. This was his second tour in Vietnam. We were patrolling a river, and the Army had advisors with various Vietnamese units in the area. He happened to be with a unit called the Vinh Long Battalion. They were all Vietnamese. They had some old French gunboats that made a lot of noise. And but he wanted to do special operations, and so I would pick him up with maybe one or two Vietnamese. The first time he went out on our boat, I think that he was testing me to see if I would deliver for him, because he said, drop me in by this old French church. It was about 10 o'clock at night. It was dark, and he was dressed. He had black pajamas on, like the Viet Cong. He delivered the war the way they delivered it. He had an AK-47 rifle. He didn't use an M-16. And at 2 or 3 in the morning, when I pulled the boat in, we were running a darkened ship. Obviously, there were no lights. He just said, coming up, I'll hear the engine. You know, give me 2 flashes, and I'll give you 4, something like that. And then bring the boat in if you get the 4 flashes. If you don't get 4 flashes, don't come in. Well, we picked him up, and that's when he told me I hadn't heard any gunfire. We'd been sort of around the bend, drifting with the current most of the night, and he had killed him with a pop flare because a pop flare is something you hit at the bottom, and it goes up and illuminates the area, but it can be used as a weapon. And we went on in 2 or 3 patrols with Olson, and he conducted these kind of operations. And you know, war is a nasty business. And unfortunately, it made my life safer, though, what Olson was doing, because the enemy didn't like it.
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe it, unfortunately, you need people like Olson, who were kind of an animal.
Right.
He didn't care about the rules, and he didn't care about what it took. And what, to me, was so sad about his story, I mean, every loss of life is awful, but you had Tozer wounded, coming back in a boat, and you get his dying words. You didn't get it with Olson. And with someone like Olson, I'm reading along going, wow, what a character. It looks like he's right off a Hollywood movie screen. And if he's going to die, it's probably going to go out in a blaze of glory. And it didn't happen.
And it's you know, one of those tragedies of war. He was going out on an ambush. I was on the river that night, but he was taking his own Boston Whaler. The Army used smaller boats sometimes. But he overloaded it. He was trying to train the Vietnamese on how to do these kind of operations, and he had too many people on that small Boston Whaler, and it flooded. And the big French gunboats that were providing cover, Vietnamese run behind him, they didn't know he'd flooded. They didn't know everybody was in the water. All of a sudden, they're running through these guys, and then they stop their engines and start picking up the troops that are in the water, but they can't find Olson. And I went back to the ship our supply ship that night, went out on patrol the next day, and they get a radio message that they'd found his body in a fishing net. And I saw that. I helped repatriate his body, and he'd been cut in the back of the head, obviously been hit by either the bow of one of those old French gunboats or one of its engines or something. He always wore bandoliers of ammunition. All that was off. He had his shirt off. He was swimming. He had his boots off. He was swimming. He just couldn't get out of the way of his own people. So he was killed in a drowning accident or an accident, a friendly fire accident, similar kind of thing.
Yeah, and like you say, almost probably just bumped his head and drowned.
Yeah, and you know, when I met his wife, Lois, she said, you know, Bob loved the Army. And she said, that's always helps me when I think about him dying. That he said, if I die over there, I die with my boots on. Don't worry about it. She said the thing about Bob Olson, and my chapter about him is called Warrior, is that he knew you had to take risk, and he would take any risk. And she said he took risks that he did not have to take. And she said that's something that I couldn't change in him. She said I knew that when we were married, that he would take risks that he didn't have to. And he said, she says, I'm still bitter about the war because our daughter Pam never knew him. She was 1 year old. And she always carried a picture that she called Bobby Dad, and that's the only thing she ever knew of her father. But that was the Olson I knew, and that's the Olson that was effective. And a couple of guys that knew him in the Army that I didn't know at the time tracked me down when I started writing this book through the family. And they're interviewed in here, and they confirm basically the kind of guy Olson was, and they have great respect for him,
yeah,
for his military skills and what he was doing. And he also spoke quite good Vietnamese, so that, like that guy he killed by that church had said, comrade to him in Vietnamese. Well, he knew it was the other side when somebody comes up and says, "Hi, comrade," to you in the middle of the night. You know, it wasn't any question. This was the enemy. So he killed him. I hope the book does justice to Olson. And
well, let me just jump in there, because here's what I'm reading this chapter on Warrior, as you say, amazing guy, totally unfair end to his life, you know, because as he said, he even told his wife, "If I go down, I'm going down with my boots on." And there was some measure of peace in his own mind. I'm sure his wife didn't like hearing that. And then he gets this nondescript, accidental drowning death. And at least I hope that when you finally track down his family 40 years later, that as much as his wife or his family might have said, why was he this risk taker? They knew that that was part of his DNA. And at least they got to hear more of the stories that made him such an amazing guy. How much did that matter to them?
Well, I think, I got an email last week, I think, from Lois Olson. She finally got back to me after reading the book. And she said, "Raleigh, I really feel great after I've read that book. That's who he was." She said he loved the Army. He was doing his job. He was professional. I mean, he was careful about it. There was one instance in the book where we went on a sweep with him, and he fired, I thought, before he should have with his gun. He didn't hurt anybody. But Olson... the people that served with Olson are proud to have served with Olson,
yeah,
because he carried out his duties. You know, Evan, when you go in the military, I used to challenge the military command a little bit. I would do my job because that's the way it works. It works from the top down. And also works because people like Olson are willing to do the dirty work of war. And I think his family... feels, I don't know if you say they feel vindicated, but they feel like they understand it better now. And I was probably the last guy or one of the last Americans to see him. And, I miss the guy. He was very interesting to talk to. And he didn't agree with my politics sometimes, I think, and my sort of, I tend to talk before I think sometimes. And he was a Mustang. He'd been an infantryman. He'd been an enlisted man. He'd come up through the ranks and had gone to Officer Canada School after he'd been in the Army for a while. So enlisted men in the military have great respect for what we in the Navy used to call Mustangs, guys that had come up through enlisted ranks and become officers. And I cherish the old friendship with these guys. Most of them I only knew for a couple months, but when you're in this kind of a situation, living in close quarters, doing the same kind of work, you really get interdependent on each
yeah.
other, and so you become close.
It's been 40 to 45 years now, and you still remember, and you still miss Tozer and Olson and Jim Rost and those guys, but you said in the book that you are unlike a lot of veterans and that you haven't had nightmares.
No, I'm lucky there. I think I've said this in the book, but why? I mean, one of the reasons I think is that I saw Vietnamese doing good things. I was doing, pacification work or turning the war over to them. I met people like Tu Trung Van, became close friends. I also was a older guy when I was in the military. I'd been through... college. I've been through graduate school. Frankly, if I hadn't have been for the draft, I probably never would have gone in the military. But I decided I'd rather be an officer in the Navy than serving on a ship as an enlisted person. And I went to Officer Candidate School. For whatever reasons, I've been fortunate there. I haven't had bad dreams and things.
And the last comment, and we're going to wrap up in just a minute with Raleigh Kidder. His book is Backtracking in Brown Water. Raleigh went back to Vietnam and then tracked down the families of three service members who died alongside him. We had a question on Facebook from someone who said that I have a service member in my family, and I don't think he wants to go back to Vietnam. You went back. Would you tell people to go back?
Oh, definitely. But I don't think you can say that it would be easy for him, this person, to go back. wasn't greatly affected by bad dreams and these kind of things from the war. Other people are more affected. And another thing of many of the men, a veteran came to a book signing last night. You know, he was always in combat or in remote areas of the country. He never was in Saigon. He never was in the marketplaces of the country like I was. Part of it was because patrol boats, we were always in and out of these areas. Part of it was I was involved in turning the war over, and I got to Saigon more. Their memories of the war don't include positive remembrances of the culture, and mine did.
It's a beautiful book. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for, honestly, when I read about the families, I'm amazed and very impressed that you took the time to find them, and I know that they are too. It doesn't happen often, but I wonder if it will spur new connections among veterans who served together for years and then drifted apart or drift away from families of service members lost. You never know. But
I hope so, and I hope that it helps those who never knew about Vietnam, who are young like you, to understand what was happening in our country at the time and why we were there.
Well, much appreciated. Great book, and thanks for taking the time to come up, Raleigh.
Hey, thank you.
Roland Kidder, the author of Backtracking in Brown Water, Retracing Life on Mekong Delta River Patrols. Find it on Amazon right now. We appreciate his time in studio. Tomorrow on Connections, hope you can join us. The first hour, we're talking about all the things that happened over the last 48 hours in Albany regarding the state budget. Raleigh used to be there as an assemblyman. I think he's glad he's not anymore. We're talking budget tomorrow. And then in the second hour, one thing that was not in the budget was $100 million for a performing arts center that the Rochester mayor asked for. What's the future of a performing arts center in Rochester or the surrounding area? Everything you need to know about that at 1 p.m. tomorrow. We'll see you then. Have a great day.